website later if you have any friends that are missing today. So I'll go ahead and jump right in, and we're going to be discussing the changes to the tax code that came into play in 2018 this year. This legislation finished up in December, and I would say it's still kind of evolving. You know, we started out the year, and although it's made it through the legislation process, that doesn't mean everything is settled from a tax standpoint, because the IRS still has to write the Treasury regulations to put those laws and kind of create the handbook for how to actually go about filing the taxes. The tax forms won't come out until January next year. And then after that, things, as we know, aren't settled, because there's all those little individual circumstances that come up where people can discuss with the IRS, debate, have audits, have things going to tax court. So I'll say this isn't the end-all be-all. We haven't reached the promised land on this, the last change to taxes. So we're taking this call from the standpoint today of, here's some things that we're aware of, may not be 100% settled for the future, but here's some things we're aware of, and we're going to be using these in our thought processes as we go about planning for this year and beyond. So I would say, if we look at the tax reform from a high level, if there was one goal for the reform, which, you know, there's a lot of parties involved in the legislation, but if there's one thing we could pick out, it would be that they wanted to simplify the tax code. We had a lot of the politicians touting the goal of filling out tax returns on a postage card. And as we've talked to CPAs, as we've looked to the legislation ourselves, I certainly don't think we've gotten to the point where people are going to be filing their postage card tax returns. There's still plenty of complication left, but there have been some changes. But I think if their goal was to simplify and to take some pressure off of the IRS, which is already well too overwhelmed to do much regular auditing of the tax returns, they did achieve that goal in one spot, and that is by having less people itemize. So in the past, about 30% of people itemized deductions on their returns in 2015, which is the last year that the IRS had released data on that. So the standard deduction used to be about $6,000 for individuals, about $12,000 for families, and those roughly doubled to about $12,000 for individuals and about $24,000 for families. So, from the jump, someone's first thought might be, well, that's good. I have more income that can be deducted off the top before I go about making my tax calculation. Well, it's not necessarily one-to-one, because alongside of that, personal exemptions were eliminated. So it used to be you could get a $4,000 exemption per individual in the household. So for a family of four, obviously that's $16,000 plus, and that was phased out for high income earners. But it's not necessarily a one-to-one increase on how much income is being deducted before we go about making the tax calculation on taxable income. Also, there's been some changes to what you can itemize. So there was a laundry list of things that people might itemize before, and you have the big ones. You have, home, home mortgage interest. If you have medical bills, things like that. But then also a lot of miscellaneous deductions have disappeared for this year. So if you paid fees for tax preparation, if you had paid advisor fees to ballast that you deducted, if you moved for a job and had expenses, if you had unreimbursed job expenses, if you had a theft, a lot of those went away. So, there's a little bit less opportunity to itemize. So we're still exploring this, but the question is, how much will people be able to itemize? That's something that we're trying to put our heads around right now as we go forward for this year. The other big item that people usually itemize, state and local taxes, that is capped this year at $10,000. So if you have a big mortgage, pay a lot of mortgage interest, property taxes, you could see that getting capped this year. That's a concern for some of our clients in Kentucky. It's especially a concern for people who live in higher price real estate areas, metro centers, you know, coastal areas where the markets are a little bit hotter, that's a chief concern as well. So we just wanted to talk about if you fall into this gap of, am I going to be itemizing next year, or perhaps I'm going to lose the ability to itemize, how should I be strategizing around that? And we think a lot of that is going to come to those two heavy hitters when it comes to itemizing is gifting and then how you treat your mortgage. So for someone who, you know, makes gifts, it's say $7,000-$10,000 area each year, that may have gotten you into the itemizing territories in the old tax code, but in the new tax code where the standard deduction is $24,000, that might not bump you up into itemizing. And, you know, everyone who donates, we have a lot of clients that have great charitable intent, but they also like to receive that tax deduction if they are gifting. So one idea we have for gifting is think about a multi-year gift. So if you have a commitment you've made to a charity, perhaps a church or a school, where you say, you know, I'm going to give a large amount, say $25,000 over 5 years, all else the same, if you give that out $5,000 for 5 years, you may not see as much tax benefit. Perhaps a more beneficial scheme would be to give $25,000 all at once. If you have the cash to do that, that could be a good idea, or we could save that money for a gift at one time. You could also run those gifts through a donor advised fund to take the deduction all in 1 year, get you over the threshold to start taking itemized deductions, and then dole those monies out of a donor advised fund as if they were a charitable checkbook annually. So that's one idea for big gifts. But then even for people who give on an annual or monthly basis, if you give to, you know, church or any charitable organization, you might think about saving those and giving them every other year. So if I give monthly to a source, maybe I will put those in a separate savings account each month this year. When we get to January 1st, we can write that check in January rather than in December. That way it starts on next year and I can get kind of twice the bang for the buck tax-wise with those charitable dollars. So that could be another option for if you're right on the edge of itemizing, maybe seeing a little bit more benefit on putting yourself into the itemized deductions area and getting a little bit off on your taxes. And even if it doesn't change the actual dollar amounts you're giving, just being more strategic with when we give them. I also wanted to give everyone kind of a beware warning. If you've worked with a CPA in the past, we have a lot of really capable CPAs we work with that will run your taxes now and also do a projection for next year. And for our most on-the-ball clients who gave their information in January and got their taxes done really quickly, their CPA may not have had complete information because the IRS didn't release federal withholding tables until late January or February this year. So I would just say, don't use your tax projection as gospel if you received it early on in the year, because there could have been changes since then. You might be actually withholding less out of your paycheck right now that could make you have a surprise tax bill come next year. And we would just say anytime that you're doing a tax projection, it's a good time to try to look at each year on its own. So if there was any special one-time things, if we had college tuition or a big gift or a big medical bill, you know, make sure if you're not expecting that next year, you know, obviously we don't have that included. And I'll end with my kind of tongue-in-cheek thought about itemizing. I said a medical bill. You know, maybe people will start thinking about their elective surgeries as a way to itemize. Are we going to be putting things off from December until January? Kind of a scary concept, but the way that things have changed with taxes, I can't say it's completely out of the realm of possibility. So that's my part of the chat, and I will hand it over to Andy. Once again, if we have any questions, just feel free to email them to us, and we'll try to get to them either on the call or follow up with you personally.
Thanks, Cameron, and thank you all for joining us today. We hope this is helpful for everybody as we try to work through the changes for 2018. As Cameron said, obviously, the if you remember the election, the goal was possibly to have taxes on a postcard. And while it's definitely not a whole lot simpler, there are some new things that I'm going to talk about that make things actually a little bit more complicated. But there are definitely some changes that we all need to be aware of. So one thing to think about is with the mortgage interest, as Cam spoke about it previously, a modest change to new mortgages going forward. Current mortgages on your primary residence, second residence, obviously you still get the $1 million threshold for the mortgage deduction on the interest. However, going forward, one change is that that will be reduced to $750,000 on new residences that are purchased looking forward. Another big change that everyone needs to be aware of is the home equity line of credits. The interest on those will no longer be included as mortgage interest deductions. So as Cameron said, this may or may not matter, as a greater probability or a greater percentage of people are using the standard deduction rather than even qualifying for these. But one misconception that I can't tell you how many times we've heard is people keep their mortgage because if they get rid of their mortgage, well, they're not going to get the nice tax benefits of that. Again, misconception, because you still have to pay the interest to get the tax benefit, but less people will probably be able to even get that tax benefit looking forward. Another rather significant change is with 529 plans. Obviously, 529 plans are still relatively new. We're just now coming across a significant number of clients who have them or are starting to use them, whether it be for children or grandchildren. But one big change for this year is that up to $10,000 of 529 money can be used for qualified tuition. So again, it has to qualify for the way the IRS describes a qualified tuition. But instead of it just being used for college now, it can be used for elementary school, secondary school, and private and parochial schools. So that's something to definitely be aware of. One thing that we would advise people to be careful about is, you know, all of a sudden your eyes get open and you say, well, hey, I don't have to pay that $10,000 tuition anymore for the private school for my kids, or I can, you know, help my kids and my grandkids by paying their private school tuition. We just want to be careful that we're not hurting ourselves in the future by using money that we've set aside for college to pay for expenses today that we're currently cash flowing. So that would be one risk that we could see from that. A secondary strategy to consider, and before implementing this, I would definitely say we'd want to see if there are any caveats where this wouldn't be allowed, but many states, unfortunately Kentucky is not one of them, give a state tax credit for making a contribution into a 529. So many things that I've seen out there about the 529 planning is for people who have children or grandchildren who are in who are in elementary school, middle school, private school, potentially essentially just making a funding into the 529 and turning right back around and then using that money to pay for the private school tuition while they're in elementary school or secondary school. So strategy to consider. Unfortunately, Kentucky, it's something we don't get a state tax credit. There are many other states that do. And if anybody on this call is involved in that, we'd be happy to kind of look through that and explore that further with you. AMT affects a lot of our clients. Good and bad thing. Bad thing, it's still around. The good thing about AMT is it's gotten a little bit more friendly. The auto-exempt amount for a married family filing jointly has gone up about $25,000. So that's a benefit for many. And also the phase out, the elimination of that exempt amount phase out starts at $1 million of earned income for 2018 versus $160,000 for 17. So I think the big important part of AMT to remember is that it's still there. We still may be susceptible to it, although it has gotten a little bit more friendly. And I think that it probably will affect a whole lot less people because now we expect to have more people taking a standard deduction anyway. The last part I'm going to talk about today is one of the biggest changes for taxes for 2018 and something that we would welcome the opportunity to talk to anybody on the call about this. We'd probably want to sit down with the CPA or accountant and loop them in the conversation. Just as a disclosure, this area is still very up for interpretation. As Cameron said, we're still lacking the authoritative guidance on a lot of these new laws, and this is one where it's still very confusing. And that has to do with the pass-through income deduction. So generally, the way that this works and the way we understand it is that it allows individuals, trusts, and estates to deduct 20% of qualified business income from partnerships, S-corps, and sole proprietors. So that's a huge advantage to business owners. And this deduction is allowed in addition to a standard deduction. So it's really beneficial, but it does come with a couple of limitations. Limitations number one has to do with service businesses. So primarily healthcare, lawyers, accounting, actuarial, performing arts, financial industry. Two industries that are specifically excluded are engineering and architecture. But basically any industry where the trade where the principal asset is the reputation or skill of one or more of his employees. For industries under that type of business model, that benefit is phased out. It starts to get phased out at $315,000. And the other limitation is that in general, the pass-through deduction with respect to the income cannot exceed 50% of the W-2 wages paid to that taxpayer. There is another slight modification of that for somebody who may have acquired real estate, and generally the sum of 25% of the W-2 wages plus 2.5% of the unadjusted basis immediately after the acquisition of the property. So the big question that we're still having a hard time understanding and getting, again, authoritative guidance on this is whether that those two limitations are based on the total household income or whether it's just the income relative to those services. So we're still trying to go through and obtain a better understanding of that. However, we are still lacking real good formal guidance that we feel really confident about. So general takeaway on that is business owners, this is a huge opportunity. Please get in contact with us. We want to explore this with you. We want to explore this with whoever's doing your taxes together. But we're still not 100% confident on understanding exactly how this is to be interpreted because there's so many different ways to look at it. So we would welcome the opportunity to chat with anybody on the call about that here in the upcoming months or weeks or whenever you all are ready. So with that, I'll turn it over to John to finish up our last couple of topics and wrap us up for today.
Thank you, Andy and Cameron. And I appreciate everyone joining us today. As you can tell, there's a lot of content here. You know, as Cameron mentioned, tax reform sort of should mean simplification, but in many ways, the law is it was a bit of a reshuffling in many ways, and the system is not that much simpler than it was before. I wanted to talk about a few issues that are that apply to some of our clients, and what's interesting is that this area, though I'm going to reference the estate and gift tax area, has been an area that's been a moving target for a number of years. Most recently, we were talking to clients about how a estate exemption of just over $5 million allowed an individual to pass a significant amount and a couple to pass over $10 million to the next generation without any estate tax liability. Now that number's doubled. We can currently transfer $11.18 million per person. So a married couple can transfer over $22 million. We were at a seminar last week, and it is estimated that of the 3 million people who will pass away after this law goes into effect, or starting this year, only about 1,700 will be required to file some sort of an estate tax return where their assets are in this area. So it's virtually eliminated almost all individuals from owing any estate tax, which is good news. It makes planning simpler. I will say from an estate planning standpoint, it has changed the conversation with many attorneys. They're still very busy. And the reason is there still are a number of reasons to hone in on a really effective estate plan other than just tax planning. Estate preservation, asset protection have become increasingly important and more of a focus of the conversation versus just tax planning. And we still think that's a major priority and in many ways a more important priority for families. So we encourage you to not ignore your estate plan just because these limits have been increased. The motivation to go out and revise and make sure your estate plan is appropriate is still there. The interesting thing about this estate tax law, however, is that it does sunset in the end of 2025, which creates a strange situation where someone might take advantage of the current ability to transfer this $11.18 million and then be reverted back to a $5 million limit. It has yet to be determined what that would mean. For instance, if you gave $10 million of assets during your lifetime and then they changed the gift tax limit to the exemption limit to $5 million, there's really no historical precedent that we can point to where that limit has been reversed. History would show that that limit has only increased over time. There was a sunset provision in 2010 for the estate tax, but that was a full elimination of the estate tax for that one calendar year. A lowering of the exemption from 11.18 to 5 would effectively increase the estate tax for people that were otherwise planning on not having to pay it on anything below 11.18 million. So it'll be interesting to see how that plays out. The one thing that I would really encourage people to do is, or to not do, I should say, is to undo your estate planning. It appears that the estate tax and the gift tax provisions are becoming sort of a battleground for politicians. It is very difficult to predict what the next 20 years will lead to. We could have a full elimination of the estate tax, or we could see it revert to a much lower number. I would hate to see someone who has gone in and met with an attorney and developed a sophisticated estate plan undo a plan that, you know, potentially might not look as effective today because of the estate planning tax law changes, but come 2026 may be very effective. So I would say stay the course. If this is a concern of yours, please reach out to us and we can talk about, you know, if there are areas within that that might need modification with your attorney during this period of time. But I would definitely not advocate fully undoing someone's plan. Another area I wanted to touch on, and these are just areas that, you know, maybe that were not headline areas of the tax reform, but are important. There were a few unique changes, almost unexpected changes with tax reform. There were about 50 areas that they were trying to address, and it was difficult up until the very end to determine which areas were going to be included in this tax reform. Divorce was affected. Interesting enough, leading up to this year, in a divorce situation, if alimony or maintenance was paid to a spouse, that money was deductible and then deductible from the person paying it and taxable to the person receiving it. That is changing for divorces that are final after this year. And so that creates a situation where you will have individuals that are paying maintenance to a divorced spouse. They will no longer be able to take that as a tax deduction. This is a benefit to the federal government because it allows, we were sort of brainstorming about this in a meeting the other day. Simply put, it allows all of the income to be taxed at the individual level, theoretically pushing people into a higher bracket, generating potentially more revenue to the federal government. So a small little nuanced thing. Hopefully this is not something anyone on the call is dealing with, but it is a change that has to be considered if you or a family member is dealing with a divorce situation right now. Child credit was actually doubled for this year from 1,000 to 2,000. And the phase out was actually increased to $400,000 in income. Previously, the phase out was $110,000 in household income. So way more people will be included in the child tax credit, which was doubled from 1,000 to 2,000. There is a new non-child dependent credit, which you can apply for elderly or disabled parents or kids over the age of 17 who are, you know, could theoretically be still classified as a dependent. That's $500 per dependent. This was sort of a replacement, so to speak, that was put in because of the personal exemptions being removed via tax reform. I also wanted to touch on Kentucky a little bit. We've touched on primarily federal things, and there's been a lot of talk in the news recently. I know not everyone on the call is probably from Kentucky, and those that will be listening from the recordings from Kentucky, but it's interesting. You know, Kentucky went through sort of a surprising amount of legislation in a short period of time, sort of unexpected, involving tax reform for the state of Kentucky that really will change things. And I'll just hit the highlights here. We will actually be going to a 5% personal income tax rate, both at the individual and the corporate rate, corporate level. That's coming down from a progressive schedule that started at just a few percent and went up to 6%. So 5% will be the flat tax rate. Probably the most interesting change that we saw was that there will actually be sales tax now applied. I believe there's 17 different industries affected by this, some of which are dry cleaning, auto repair, bowling alleys, fitness centers, country clubs, where you'll actually be paying a sales tax on those bills that you previously were not. You know, we were talking in our meeting the other day, and the point was made, you know, the interesting thing about all of these areas is that these are things that cannot be mobilized, that cannot be done online. These are all physical presence businesses that exist within the state. It's an interesting sort of revenue grab that we see the state of Kentucky doing, trying to assess businesses that currently are not generating any sales tax. From our client's perspective, the biggest change was the pension exclusion change. Currently, for last year, excuse me, $41,110 of IRA and pension distributions was Kentucky tax-free. That number is going to be going down to $31,110. That's also important for people that are doing Roth conversion strategies. We have a number of clients that convert IRAs to Roth IRAs or Roth 401ks, excuse me, traditional 401ks to Roth 401ks. We were able to use this $41,110 sort of free conversion amount. We didn't have to pay any state income tax on that conversion, only paying federal income tax. That's going down to $31,000. We think this is going to be a big target area over the coming years. Kentucky is considered to be a very retiree-friendly tax state. But if you think about all of the retirees and all of the pension revenue and IRA distributions that happen in the state, if every retiree is receiving $31,110 and not having to pay any income tax on it, still, that's a lot of revenue that the state's giving up. So we think that could be a target area with years to come. Kentucky is competing for business, like so many. We've heard it from the governor and the legislature, trying to make Kentucky a dynamic state. It obviously has challenges and revenue challenges that it and bills to pay, so to speak. But we're trying, you know, you can see with this lower tax rate, the state's making an effort to try to become more competitive. It will be interesting to see, you know, with states, we're seeing businesses move to tax-free states, you know, going to from a 6 to a 5% corporate tax rate. Is that really going to move the needle? It'll be interesting to see. And I just want to wrap up here. You know, I've probably looked at, you know, a dozen tax returns in the last week to 2 weeks, just people finishing up. And most of the tax software that people are receiving there, at least from the CPAs that they're working with, is projecting what their 2017 and their 2018 differences would look like. And anecdotally, that number it tends to be in that 1 to 3% range. I haven't seen that many people where the number was, you know, 15% less in tax, for instance. One thing I did notice, and I know Andy and Cameron made mention to this, the withholding schedules from the federal level are considerably more generous to the employee. So we're finding that withholding amounts coming through payroll seem to be a little on the light side based on what we were expecting. So what that basically means, particularly those that have sort of hybrid income sources, maybe you have some self-employment income or some dividend income and interest income from your portfolio. We really need and want to make sure that you're taking a really close look at your income sources and how much is being withheld from your payroll if you're still employed, just to make sure that you're on pace. I could see a scenario where someone assumes they're having enough withheld and then come next year owes a big tax bill if they don't go through this analysis. So just something I would recommend, would not take long. We have sophisticated tax software that we can utilize to give you some semblance of a projection, and we work with individual CPAs all the time. They keep that information from your previous year up to date, typically in their systems, and we can give them sort of projections of dividend income and things like that for this year if we want to get a 2018 projection. I think this is an important year to do this well ahead of the curve. So much of our tax planning we do with clients, I feel like, ends up happening in the fourth quarter of the year, considering a lot of the changes that we've gone through for the last 30 minutes. There's a lot out there that could affect your plan. So we would say, let's tackle this sooner rather than later. If it requires you to modify your situation, it's so much better if we have more time in the calendar left to do that. So as you know, we're not CPAs. We don't do tax preparation, but it is important that we have an expertise in how the investment and financial planning we do for our clients can impact people's taxes. So this is an area we spend a lot of time on. So please reach out to us. If it's an area that we feel is past our knowledge base, we will be more than happy to bring in an expert to help make sure you end up with the best advice possible. So with that, I want to thank all of you all for joining us this afternoon. We will be archiving this call on our website. I would say we'll have that available and published to the site within the next week. If you have any questions about this call or following up from this call, feel free to contact our office or email any one of us, and we'll be more than happy to help you out. So again, thanks for joining us this afternoon, and have a good rest of your week. Take care.